Well, it is time now for Small State Big History, the online review of Rhode Island history, and to talk about an article that is on Small State Big History right now called A History of Election Tickets in Rhode Island. We welcome back Pat Connolly. Pat, nice to have you back with us.
Hi, how are you, Bruce?
I am good. Thank you, sir. Always great to talk to you. We know it's going to be an interesting discussion, and we're going to talk today about a collection of what are called Rhode Island printed election tickets, and these are different from ballots. Tell us what the difference is between these election tickets and ballots.
Well, a ballot would be a list of the candidates, and you check off a name. Your election tickets would be separately printed documents that would be for one particular party or another, and you'd sign those and submit them as your vote. So it that particular form encouraged the development of the party system.
Yeah.
You have your first proxies, so to speak, or tickets developing in the 1740s. And at that time, Rhode Island was developing the first two-party system in America. A professor at the University of Wisconsin, Jackson Turner Main, who was the dead now, but he was the authority on the development of the American party system, says that the party system originated in the 1740s and 1750s in Rhode Island. And one of the things that facilitated that relatively stable and identifiable two-party system was the use of these tickets or proxies, as they were called, because they were cast in the town and then brought by one of the town's deputies to the General Assembly to be counted. And so this the two-party system consisted mainly of Stephen Ward and Joshua Babcock. They were westerly politicians, and they represented the South County planters for the most part, and also the Newport merchants. And the other major party was led by Stephen Hopkins, who later becomes a signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
And that consists of Providence County and northern Rhode Island, basically. And so it's a kind of an early North versus South battle that was very spiritedly fought. In fact, in the late 1750s, the Hopkins faction got control of the General Assembly, which was kind of all powerful. The governor had very meager powers. The assembly was dominant,
yeah,
and remained so through the
20th century. I was just going to say, some people say it's still the case today.
Yeah, well, through the 20th century, but the separation of powers amendments modified that a little in 2005. To give you an example, the Hopkins people got control of the General Assembly, and among the many powers of the assembly was to create new towns. I called it, in a way, political cell division, political
sure.
mitosis. And in the late 1750s, when they were in control of the legislature, to teach Ward and Babcock a lesson, they took the town of Westerly, and they separated the northern half of the town, and they called it Hopkington. So when Ward and Babcock looked north, they found a town named for their arch political rival. So they played hardball in those days here in Rhode Island.
There was no fooling around. That's an amazing story. How'd you like that? How's that for a legacy? Right? Who's your town named after? Well, it was a political infight. It was like the five families getting together. My goodness.
Yep.
It's amazing. So, well, I guess it becomes clear that the two parties didn't get along any better than the two parties do today.
That's pretty much so. And even in the 1790s, there's a new book out, as a matter of fact, by a fairly noted popular historian by the name of H.W. Brands, B-R-A-N-D-S, and it's called Founding Partisans. And it's subtitled Hamilton, Madison, Jefferson, and Adams, The Brawling Birth of American Politics. So it's very, very acrimonious then. It's been throughout American history. The thing that makes it, I think, so bad today and so dangerous is now you've got the media and your social media, the internet, and everything else, so that everybody seems to be out there throwing in their beliefs, and sometimes doing it rather intemperately. So it's much easier to stir up the entire body politic today through modern technology than certainly it was through a couple of random newspapers back in the 18th or even 19th century. You know?
But the thing of it is, though, Pat, though, going back to these election tickets, you had the industrialists who exerted as much influence as what we're impugning the social media giants today, are we not?
Well, to a degree, but I wouldn't even compare that, because in Rhode Island, although if you had a real estate, and by 1760, if you had what amounted to $134 worth of real estate, that was the competent estate that you needed in order to become a freeman and to vote.
Ah.
And the thing was, you had a rural and agricultural society at that time, and even in the towns like a Bristol or Newport or Providence, your individuals owned the land basically on which they lived. And so land holding among free white adult males, which was the political denominator,
you bet,
was relatively widespread. So you don't get a place like you do later on in the early 19th century, where you've got tons of factory workers coming in that live in factory housing and tenements and things like that can't meet that real estate requirement for voting. And of course, that was one of the things that triggered an uprising in the 1840s known as the Dorr Rebellion to remove the real estate requirement for voting. Rhode Island was the only state that had maintained it. So we went from the most democratic in the colonial period, where our charter gave us the right to elect our governor and our general officers. That didn't exist in the other 13 except for Connecticut. Connecticut was the only other state that didn't have either a royal or proprietary governor. They had a popularly elected, like Rhode Island. But in Rhode Island, in Connecticut, there were religious restrictions and other types of restrictions on freemanship. So Rhode Island was clearly the most democratic. But even being so, it's estimated that of those that had the right to vote, maybe only half of them exercised that right. And today, up until at least 2020, we were always in the 55 to 60% range of political participation in presidential elections. And Rhode Islanders tended to elect the people that were known, the wealthy, the upper socioeconomic, so that we were a democracy, but we were a democracy, you might say, as I put it in one of my books, of indifference, meaning half of the people voting, and deference, the ones that did vote, kind of voted as we tend to do today for the prominent people that you recognize.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. It has not changed all that much. I would say that the idea of 50% of the electorate voting would be very, very optimistic years, when you have recent elections in which 10% voted or 30% voted.
We were very democratic. As a matter of fact, when individuals come through Rhode Island from England, as I wrote in the preface to the book, I said Rhode Island's political antics, not to mention its autonomy and broad-based balloting, scandalized many a squeamish observer. In the eyes of the colony's conservative critics, the land of Roger Williams, even on the eve of revolt, was, quote, dangerously democratic, unquote, according to 18th-century standards. Chief Justice Daniel Horseman of New York, in a report during the Gaspe investigation, disdainfully described Rhode Island as, quote, a downright democracy, unquote, whose governmental officials were, quote, entirely controlled by the populace. And conservative Massachusetts Governor Thomas Hutchinson lamented to George III that Rhode Island was the nearest to a democracy of any of your colonies.
How dare
so,
we?
So we got a situation in my constitutional history. I call it democracy in decline, because we had a fairly broad-based democracy up through the American Revolution, but by not getting a written constitution, because our charter was so satisfactory, and because of the great influx of immigrants, mostly Irish Catholics, during the 1820s, 30s, and 40s, a fewer and fewer percentage of the population were entitled to vote. So I called Rhode Island from the Revolution to the Dorr Rebellion, I called my book Democracy in Decline.
Yeah. It really is so epic of just how things have not changed, you know.
Yeah. Human nature doesn't change, and that's the key, I think, if you understand that. I mean, I studied at Providence College there and studied the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas, who was voted the greatest mind of the millennium there when we back in 2000 when we were retrospecting back to 1000. And his philosophy, in essence, that human nature is unchangeable.
You bet.
I definitely believe that.
Well, we share a common thread here, Pat Connolly, because my nephew, who graduated Providence College, teaches a course on Thomas Aquinas at Salve Regina.
Okay.
So I've got you. I know from which you speak. Absolutely. So when we talk about these election tickets, which is the story that we're talking about here with smallstatebighistory.com, when did the election ticket become the secret ballot? It was fairly late in the game, all things considered, here in Rhode Island.
Yeah, way late. Back in the early 1850s, when the followers of Thomas Wilson Dorr gained temporary control of the General Assembly under a governorship of Philip Allen, Dorr's uncle, who didn't favor the rebellion, but who was reform-oriented and not a nativist. They put a secret ballot law in, and almost immediately thereafter, the Know-Nothing movement developed, which was Irish Catholic mainly, yeah, and anti-immigrant, and they repealed the secret ballot law. So Rhode Island went without a secret ballot till 1889. And it was at that particular point that a hard-driving Irishman by the name of Charles E. Gorman, mm-hmm, was able to gain the speakership of the House of Representatives in a very brief window of Democratic ascendancy, at least in that in that particular House. And they were able to push through a secret ballot in 1889. And Gorman had argued, even taken the case to the Congress of the United States, that Rhode Island it was lacking a democratic system, because in the type of balloting that was taking place, where you used the proxies and all, you had to vote and sign your ballot in the presence of a mill owner or the mill owner's representative. And the mill owners were usually Republican at that time. And therefore, you get a situation where you vote the wrong way and you get another slip probably in a day or two, and it's a pink one.
That's it. Well, look at how, again, things have not changed. I will take your mill owner of that era and put that mill owner right next to the social media mogul of today. If you dare to post something that goes against the conventional wisdom of those who are in control of the social media, it's not even a person, it's an algorithm, you are canceled. Point of view is not tolerated.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I was, for 20 years, I was 1995 inductee to the Rhode Island Heritage Hall of Fame, and 20 years as president, and I stepped down last March. And Hall of Fame, in this last encounter towards the end of 2023, named their inductees for 2024. And one of the inductees was Michael Flynn, yes, of Middletown, yep, one of the nominees. And the idea was, the reason, you know, because I had to step forward as a lawyer and be like the volunteer general counsel, because there was tremendous outcry. And there were over 500 emails that came in, and only about 3 or 4 of them positive. So it was a very, very definitely a coordinated effort. When it came into the Hall of Fame, some of them very obscene and vulgar and derogatory, and few, you know, calm and learned. But most of them, very, very very vulgar, very nasty. And of the 505 that were the hall was able to count, 501 denounced the Hall of Fame. And of course, I had stepped forward to be the spokesman for the Hall of Fame, even though I was no longer the chairman or the director. And I got hammered as well. And so there was a national social media coordinated campaign to denounce the Hall of Fame, to, of course, denounce Flynn. Mm-hmm. And I think the way the Hall of Fame did it, they looked and saw that he had been kind of set up in interrogated without counsel by a sort of a surprise move relative to a Russian investigation that proved to be a hoax.
Yep.
And he pleaded guilty, but only to probably avert two things, the indictment of his son and to save some of the money he'd expended defending himself. And then he was pardoned by Trump. So the board looked at that and looked at the rest of his career. And there were 11 votes out of 20, which was a sufficient number to secure him induction. Now, we've heard, you know, in the aftermath of the trauma that he suffered, he's gone to some level of extremism, and which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making here is that the social media, the barrage was enormous. When I was president of the Hall of Fame from 1903 through early 23, we inducted some individuals that could have been relatively controversial, but I never received one letter or one email congratulating us about a particular selection or condemning the Hall of Fame about a particular one. Not one. And we put in over 200 people during that 20-year period. And you know, with Flynn, there was over 500 of them.
And there's the cancel culture right there. Difference is that they didn't fire you. You know, I mean, there's no difference.
As a matter of fact, by stepping out there, I was brave enough to go out there, even though I wasn't even on the board to vote. But I took the hits, took the blows, and did it my way. Yeah, a lot of angry people out there.
For
and,
no reason.
You know, your party's changed, too, like the Republicans, you know, don't want to bash them too much for the mill owners because they were the ones that eliminated slavery and enacted the 14th Amendment. and so
hard to keep that in mind, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
and the Democrats were certainly in Rhode Island the reforms, but in the South they were the ones that fought a civil war to preserve slavery and try to block ratified the 14th Amendment under coercion and. Yeah. On and on. The party's changing their positions, too. So, you know, even the Democratic Party of my childhood in South Providence is not the Democratic Party that I see today.
That's for sure. Well, Pat Connolly, it is always thought-provoking to talk to you. We look forward to reading this story on smallstatebighistory.com. It is also an introduction of our friend Russell DeSimone's book, Rhode Island Election Tickets.
And he's the guy. He's a leading Rhode Island collector of antiquarian material. He's a brilliant writer and historian, even though he was trained as a mathematician. And he comes from Middletown.
There you go.
So he's right down there in your midst. Russell J. DeSimone.
You bet.
And he's treasurer of the Heritage Harbor Foundation. So we don't want to forget Russ in all of this.
For sure. We have had him on many times, and he is always great to talk to, as are you. And we thank you very much, Pat Connolly. Always great to have you on.
Okay. Thank you, Bruce.
Yes, sir. SmallStateBigHistory.com.